Dennis Halliday, former director of the UN Iraq program.
Back in 1990, economic sanctions were seen, I believe, as a good alternative to military activity and force. Since then, however, they've been sustained now for, what, over 9 years. They have had an impact on the people of Iraq, which is, in the view of many of us, genocidal, in the sense that economic sanctions, on top of the damage done by the Americans and others in the Gulf War, has led to the death of possibly 1 or 1.5 million Iraqi people, and particularly children. So the maintenance of these economic sanctions breached the Geneva Conventions on warfare, because, as we all know, civilians are not to be targeted in war nor in economic sanctions programs.
Dr. Faraz Abdul Abbas, MD, Basra Children's Hospital.
The general condition in our country deteriorated since 1990. Also the deficiency of the vaccinations, including the absence of basic things like toilet paper. This leads to outbreaks of many infectious diseases.
Adrat Saleh, 6 years. Her weight corresponds to the age of 1 year or less because of the deficiency of protein. The 6-month-old infant suffers from the chronic diarrhea. He needs special formula of milk to stop the diarrhea. This medical milk is not available.
In 1991, the United Nations voted a resolution meant to ease the impact of sanctions on the Iraqi population.
The idea behind the oil for food program was simple. That is, the Iraq could use a certain amount of its oil revenues for the purposes of taking care of the needs of the Iraqi people.
Dr. Labib Kamawi.
When the thing started, there were some incidents that are, it's like black comedy, that are funny, because one of the companies had a contract to supply eggs, and the contract was sent for approval, and it seems the American delegate, without even looking, put it on hold and asked for explanation about the end use of this product. And the answer came back, you know, you boil it and you eat it, or you fry it and you eat it. I mean, these are eggs. This should give you an idea about how things are done.
Dennis Halliday, former director of the UN Iraq program.
So oil for food, in my view, where it has maintained a level of intake in terms of food, inadequate, although that certainly is, it has failed in terms of addressing the needs of the Iraqi people. And thus we've seen the maintenance of malnutrition, the death of infants in particular.
But since yesterday, we missed 2 babies because of shortage of oxygen supply due to no electrical power necessary to make the oxygen.
This baby will die at any time because there is no oxygen. But we choose that baby because his weight is higher than this. Chance of survival of that baby better than this baby.
Dr. Faraz Abdul Abbas.
I feel sad because I can't do anything. I can't help these patients.
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
We have no gripe or animus against the people of Iraq. Our problem is with its government.
This baby named Amal Salem, 1 year old infant, and we diagnosed her as pneumonia. She couldn't receive the proper treatment of antibiotic, and therefore the baby died. Especially we have shortage of clathrin antibiotic. This patient need it.
Dr. Labib Kamawi, Human Rights Association President, Jordan.
What is it to the UN and to the Americans to impose sanctions on medicine? I mean, only crazy people would do this. I mean, this is medicine. What's multi-use? Are they going to make atomic bomb out of a few tablets of medicine here or there?
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
Let me make clear that the purpose of the Security Council resolutions, with sanctions as their tool, was so that Iraq should not be a threat to peace and security again.
We uncovered the bulk of what the Iraqis were able to produce in terms of chemical weapons, biological weapons, ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons.
Former UNSCOM team leader Scott Ritter.
The infrastructure that Iraq used to produce these weapons has largely been dismantled, destroyed, or under monitoring by the weapons inspectors. So we have a good idea of what should be left. It's not very much.
Despite that, the U.S. has consistently moved the goalposts and said it's not enough if they abide by the requirements regarding weapons of mass destruction. Instead of saying, if you abide by the requirements of the UN resolution, sanctions will be lifted, the U.S. message is, it doesn't matter whether you comply or not, we're not going to lift sanctions anyway.
Dennis Halliday.
When UNSCOM began, I believe it was a legitimate effort to track down and destroy dangerous weaponry. And in fact, the Atomic Energy Agency and others were just about ready to clear UNSCOM, their work, and agree that Iraq was clean. Then Richard Butler was appointed, and he reopened many of the issues that in fact had been closed and seemed to bring a new element to the investigation, perhaps very much supported by Washington.
Scott Ritter.
Unfortunately, the actions of its executive chairman, Richard Butler, in concert with the United States government, allowed UNSCOM to be manipulated in a way which was outside the guidelines set forth by its true boss, the Security Council. The United States and the United Kingdom used UNSCOM as a trigger for the initiation of military action. The United States and Great Britain used information gathered by weapons inspectors to provide targets for their bombing. This is an accepted fact. So UNSCOM as an organization has been discredited.
Dennis Halliday.
It's true that an inspection entity of that sort can be manipulated politically and give an excuse to the more aggressive member states for further military action. And in a sense, we have that every day, almost every day of the week, when UK and American planes are bombing Iraq.
Nasira Sadoum, Director, Gulf War Foundation, Baghdad.
The Americans are bombing what they call the Iraqi radars, which is not true. They are bombing infrastructure. They are bombing homes of people. They have even bombed a tent of Bedouins with their animals, with the whole family who are dead. Every single day there was a bombing of Iraq. But not one of the media have spoken about that.
Rhonda Habib, Agence France-Presse, Jordan.
Now, if you don't see it in the media abroad, it's because I think people are, you know, it's becoming too small a story for it's not as interesting as before.
Journalist and writer in Jordan, Michelle Haj.
On the 17th of January 1993, Bush sent 42 missiles on that date. One of them hit Al-Rashid Hotel when I was there.
Germany. I'm a German journalist from Bild-Zeitung. I think I'm the only one that was injured.
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
The air attacks that you refer to are defensive in nature. Since 1991, there has been a no-fly zone in the north of Iraq. This no-fly zone was imposed, I will recall for your audience, after the Iraqi regime forced the exodus of over 500,000 Kurdish inhabitants of northern Iraq. The UN passed Resolution 688 that said that this should not happen, and then a no-fly zone was imposed in the north.
There is no reference in any UN resolution to the establishment of no-fly zones in northern or southern Iraq.
Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies.
The U.S. has imposed them and, with the British, kept them in place, and the result is that civilians in the north and in the south, whose lives ostensibly are to be protected by the establishment of those no-fly zones, are being killed not by Iraqi soldiers or Iraqi planes, but by American bombings that go off course. That's who is killing the Iraqi civilians now in the northern and southern no-fly zones. One of the very bitter lessons of these years of war, both economic war and military war against Iraq, is that for the United States government, and I think for most governments in the Security Council, humanitarian considerations are simply not enough to influence policy. We have, of course, the famous statement by Madeleine Albright in 1996 when she was asked about the deaths at that time of 500,000 Iraqi children that have died as the result of sanctions. And of course, she did not dispute the figure. She simply thought about it for a moment and then said, on balance, we think it's worth it.
The 60-minute show, entitled Punishing Saddam, where State Secretary Madeleine Albright made this insensitive remark, aired on May the 12th, 1996. It has since been censored by CBS under political pressure. If, indeed, the price is worth it, as Ms. Albright declared, again, who is paying that price? And what does it buy? Is it really an attempt to force Saddam out of power, as is being claimed by the United States administration?
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
Well, the Iraqi Liberation Act is an additional expression of our concern about the regime that's in charge in Baghdad. The United States believes that this situation involving Iraq would be immeasurably better were Saddam Hussein no longer the leader of Iraq. The act passed by Congress is designed to provide support and resources.
According to the Iraqi Liberation Act, they said that they are ready to give the Iraqi opposition non-lethal equipment.
Writer with the Iraqi opposition, Ahmed Al-Jabbar.
They are thinking about computers and mobiles and desks and so on, and I don't think that by mobiles and computers we will be able to remove Saddam Hussein from power.
In other parts of the world, Washington has never proved to come short of ideas and solid means to get rid of governments deemed hostile or worth removing.
In 1992, when we first established the INC, we were planning to have an uprising, national resistance against the regime. In April 1995, we started this uprising, the military operation of it, but the Americans refused again to support that uprising, and Saddam Hussein was able to crush it.
To this day, Saddam Hussein remains Washington's most convenient bogeyman, justifying the continuing pressure on Iraq and in the Gulf region in general.
Former director of the UN Iraq program, Dennis Halliday.
There was a belief, I think, for many years that somehow sanctions would lead to the removal of Saddam Hussein. Very naive, because in fact, economic sanctions and their impact have made Saddam Hussein stronger.
Why the embargo strengthened the regime of Saddam Hussein?
Former Iraqi oil minister Fadel Chalabi.
First, because the mere livelihood of people became dependent on the government. He controlled people through starving them. But more important is that the embargo created a new class living very comfortably attached to him. You see nobody getting 100 times as much as a doctor. Why? Because he is part of the security system. And therefore he should be fed well, he should be given good accommodation. He created a power base of people whose daily interests were tied to him, so that when he goes, they lose all these privileges.
Dennis Halliday, former director of the UN Iraq program.
Sanctions have sustained Saddam Hussein in power, and there are many of us worldwide who believe that is also a policy of the United States. Because of the Saddam Hussein threat, quote unquote, the Americans have sold arms on a massive scale to the Arab states, the Gulf, Israel, of course, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia.
International arms trade analyst Bill Hartung.
After the Gulf War, U.S. arms manufacturers and the Pentagon took advantage of making new arms sales to the Middle East at the rate of about $1 billion a month.
Marwan al-Hassem, former Jordanian foreign minister.
The oil-producing countries in 1990 had hundreds of billions of dollars in reserve. Now they have maybe hundreds of billions in debt.
But Saddam also serves a more direct goal for the Pentagon.
Ramsey Clark.
The United States had to have a justification to remain in the area. It intended to maintain major military forces that could protect and control the natural resources of the region. It wasn't particularly welcome. The people of Saudi Arabia didn't really want U.S. troops on their soil. So Saddam was chosen to remain the devil that would justify the presence of the American angels in this region.
Bill Hartung.
After the Gulf War, the buildup at places like King Khalid Military City, which was supposed to be temporary, has become sort of a bridge for a possible long-term U.S. military base in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East. There's now thousands of U.S. troops regularly in Saudi Arabia. So, at least on a de facto basis, Saudi Arabia has become a military base for U.S. forces in the Middle East. Unless there's a change of regime, that base could well end up being permanent.
Proclaimed as a sweeping victory by almost all Western media, the Gulf War and the subsequent crisis with Iraq have indeed amounted to a superior victory for Washington. Paramount arms sales at a level never seen before. At last, huge permanent military bases in Saudi Arabia, resulting in a better control of the oil flow and a better leverage on its pricing. The great losers, on the other hand, are the Iraqi population, still under a Stalin-like dictatorship and slowly dying from starvation.